you. Golly gosh, I sure am sorry I offended you, you white trash piece of shit.
Welcome back, listener. It's episode 19. Today we're looking at Tom Ford's latest, the thriller Nocturnal Animals, and Scorsese's best-known thriller Cape Fear. I'm Jared.
And I'm here, too.
I'm Ethan. God damn it.
We're the hard men to please. I'm looking at this trailer for Barry, about
Barry.
Barack Obama.
Oh, Barry.
Arriving in New York City.
I can't wait for Donnie.
Yeah, good God, dude. Every time I remember that guy's going to be president, like, my brain, like, rejects the information, and I just, like, have, like, a intestinal convulsion.
Yeah, it's the same reaction I get whenever I think of my student debt.
Yeah.
Maybe if I don't think about it, it'll go away.
Yeah, pretty much. Oh, man. This is weird, because they just came out, like, maybe a month or two ago with that, what was that movie that was all about Barack Obama and Michelle Obama's first date?
Oh, this isn't that same movie? This is another movie about Barack Obama.
This is on Netflix, and actually it could be a TV show. I don't even know.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Fuck this.
So stupid.
It'd be funny, though, if they had, yeah. They just had, like, dropped a little bunch of hints in there where, like, I don't know, he's watching some sci-fi movie, and it's basically like a drone strike. He's like, That's intriguing.
Is there no matter? Let's watch Independence Day.
Yeah.
I like the cut of their jib. Or Stealth. He's watching Stealth. That's a good.
I never saw that, actually. Is that still the worst movie you have ever seen?
Didn't I already proclaim that on this podcast for another movie? Oh, the Blair Witch. Yeah, the new Blair Witch.
So is the new Blair Witch worse than Stealth?
It's probably worse, but I saw Stealth in the theaters, so that's still the worst movie I've seen in theaters.
Ooh.
Hands down.
Yeah. That one, I'm really glad that, like, Bowie got his act together and recorded, like, The Next Day, which was a shitty album, but then Black Star, which was an awesome album, because there was a point at which the shitty, like, electro-pop song he made for the movie Stealth would have been, like, his last recorded work, and good God.
Yeah, I mean, people would have forgotten. Like,
yeah, but it's always a shame.
That's true. It's there. It's lingering.
Yeah, I mean, he went out, like, really perfectly on top. He's like, I'm back, and I'm out.
Yeah, I'm back, and here's why I'm dying in this album, and I'm dead.
Yeah. Get ready. 2016's gonna suck. Peace. But anyway, you want to talk about the Silence trailer, which was exciting. Martin Scorsese back again, back at it again at Krispy Kreme.
I really just had one question to ask for this movie and another recent movie starring Andrew Garfield. Is why do we keep making Andrew Garfield do accents that he can't do? just let him do his own accent.
Yeah, I don't
or
know
an American accent. He's good at that too.
Yeah, he's got a British accent, which if you're doing, I don't know when, where, like who the Silence folks are. They're all Italian priests, I took it.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, for God's sake, if fucking Liam Neeson can get under that bar of doing an Italian accent, then Garfield's got no chance. I feel like,
well,
maybe I hate him.
What's the other movie he's in? Oh, the Conscientious Objector.
Yeah, Hacksaw Ridge, where he does like a really dopey, kind of insulting Southern accent.
Yeah, he's doing like Sling Blade.
yeah, he is. It just makes me wonder if he's like, is he actually any better than like Orlando Bloom, or are they on the same level? But he was in The Social Network, and so people kind of think he's got chops.
Yeah, probably part of it. He snuck himself into a good movie. Orlando Bloom was never really in a good movie, was he? I mean, Lord of the Rings is a very specific movie.
Yeah, he was in Black Hawk Down, but he just fell out of a chopper, and then I don't even know if that movie was good. I saw it in theaters, and I thought it was fine, but
We'll talk about it next week.
Yeah. Yeah, so that Silence trailer was disappointing, because I always just assumed from all the pictures they put out initially that it was, like, definitely starring Liam Neeson, and I was like, blah, Liam Neeson, Martin Scorsese, and then it's, like, a whole lot of Andrew Garfield, and not a lot of the guy who plays baby Darth Vader.
Yeah, Adam Driver, who also, I don't know if I trust his Italian accent either, but we'll see. I don't think Liam Neeson even has a line in the trailer, does he?
I don't think so. I think he just looks sad praying, but his acting while saying nothing is still superior. I think Adam Driver gets points for me because he's so fucking weird looking that, like, I feel like he'd have to be a really bad actor to not still, you know, work for me.
What do you mean work for you?
I mean, like, in the role where it's like, oh, I see this guy is not, you know, he doesn't have movie star good looks. Kind of like that weird looking kid in Stranger Things, the boy, the photographer guy.
The weird looking one?
yeah, kind of funny looking. that one. Kind of funny looking people in movies.
Yeah, there's something about an actor who doesn't have actor looks. Makes him a little more interesting on the screen among actors.
Yeah, I mean, just shy of Benedict Cumberbatch, obviously. Like, that's a little much. Like, Jesus.
Yeesh. I don't know.
Do we have any burn victims that we need? We need someone who can play a burn victim?
What do you mean? Andrew Garfield?
He just looks like Benedict Cumberbatch looks like his whole face was burned and, like, replaced with, like, a too small face that had to be stretched over his skull.
Yeah, someone just gave him a lot of Sour Patch Kids as a kid. Squeeze his face, maybe. Is tiny. What was the scale we have? The how weird is Benedict Cumberbatch really scale?
Yeah.
Really, guys? That's the best content we've put out so far, that scale.
Yeah, I keep pestering Derek to do more of those things. Last week I was like, hey, man, and I felt bad because I asked him this in, like, maybe about noon on a Monday. And I was like, hey, if you get that Now in Theaters article out by tonight, like, we can talk about it on the podcast and, like, you know, kind of like what we're doing now, like, for trailers. And he was like, oh, okay. And then, like, he just didn't do one last week at all.
I'll show him. I won't do anything.
That fucker.
Yeah, we'll dock his pay for that.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of trailers, I feel like it should be illegal to show a trailer like the Nocturnal Animals trailer, because it's not only incredibly deceptive to what the movie's about, and it makes it seem like it's like a, you know, crazy X thriller, but it also, like, reveals, like, almost the entire movie.
Does it? I don't know if it does.
I mean, it shows quite a lot. I feel like part of the strength of Nocturnal Animals is not seeing a whole lot of the Jake Gyllenhaal story. And the fact that the trailer reveals so much of it is, I feel like it will ruin people's experiences. I guess we should say there is a spoiler-free review on the website now. So we're doing spoilers.
Ooh. Yeah.
Podcast is a spoiler... not free
spoiler
zone.
Rich. Spoiler rich.
Zone. There you go.
I had a lot
of our notes say director
thoughts.
Tom Ford, written by Amy Adams. What the fuck?
That can't be right.
No, it's also written by Tom Ford.
Yeah, written directed.
Like a rock. That's what Tom Ford should say all the time.
Yeah. Or that, you ever listen to that Jay-Z song called Tom Ford?
I think it's actually that's the Chevy song, isn't it?
Ooh, like a rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tom Ford. What is Ford's logo or their jingle? Do they have a jingle? Built Ford Tough? There you go.
Built Ford Tough, yeah.
Dude,
Tom Ford, he's a fashion guy. Did you know his name coming into this at all?
Tom Ford? No. They kind of splatted out there in the trailer, which I think was one of the trailers that I stopped watching halfway through because I didn't want to ruin it. But so I was like, oh, man, who is this guy? Maybe I've missed a lot of his stuff. He's like one other movie.
Well, he's a fashion designer. And he's done.
He's a fashion designer turned. Well, that kind of makes me hate him. Is that okay?
No, that's totally legitimate. And I do like that you didn't know about him seeing the movie, because I did know about him. So the whole time I was kind of thinking like, I don't know about this fashion designer guy making movies, because I'm a close-minded asshole.
So he really had to like meet a bar that you had set up for him.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't help that like he really puts it out there that, hey, this is a Tom Ford movie you're watching.
Yeah, this is Tom Ford as hell. Tom Ford and Sons.
So the whole time I was like, oh, this like looks so nice, but that was like one of my criticisms. Like, yeah, it looks too
that it looked too nice. It gave away that it was directed by a fashion designer.
I was just much more critical of like the staging and all the everything.
Yeah, so you didn't like this movie, but I did. But did you want to start with that synopsis?
With the synopsis of the movie?
Yeah.
What else you wrote here?
Synopsis. Yeah. I did that. I wrote that down for you. I mean, I could read it, I guess. Now it's weird.
No, I'm reading it. A rich LA douchebag gets a book in the mail from her awesome ex-husband, comma. And the book kicks so much ass, she can't stop thinking about it during her boring life and boring tub sessions.
And that's pretty much the movie, isn't it?
That's a pretty good synopsis. I wouldn't necessarily call her ex-husband awesome.
I would say awesome in the sense that everything about, like, okay, so obviously they broke up, but like every flashback shows him being like really pretty reasonable and her just kind of turning into a bitch. Like,
yeah.
Like the whole setup of the movie is that her mom is like a cartoon of a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And she's basically like, unless she was like walked in on the shoulders of like four like black slaves, she couldn't be more of like just a absolute caricature of like a, you know, wealthy, racist, sexist, clueless,
just classist,
aristocrat. Yeah.
Elitist.
And she says, oh, you're going to, you know, you're eventually going to really appreciate, you know, the finer things in life, and you won't want to be with this sexy, cool writer anymore. And she's like, no, mom, that'll never happen. And like the next time we check in with her, she's like, our apartment's too small. This sucks. Don't you want to get a real job?
See, and yeah.
I was like, where was the transformation?
Yeah, the rich LA douchebag in question is Amy Adams. And that was one of my problems like throughout the entire movie. Like, it lacks a lot of subtlety that I kind of was expecting. I was expecting it to be more of like an art house movie, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's like, it kind of just like sets you up and then immediately gives it away right then and there. Like that scene you're talking about.
Yeah, like, there's okay. Really no mistaking what that's about and who's the dick.
No. And just, there's no mistaking like what the imagery is meaning, and it's just very flat and very like, it doesn't have too much depth to it.
Her whole world is it's kind of like, I don't know, maybe because he is a fashion designer, so he thought like if he put like just what he thought was a really neutral take on that scene, everyone else would be like, all right, that's a pretty subtle but damning, you know, critique of that lifestyle. But because he's in it, he felt the need to like really play up how vacuous everyone was in that area.
I thought about that too. I was wondering like if this movie, like, I wonder if it plays really well in the LA art scene, if like he's kind of playing to that crowd, and it's almost like maybe this movie isn't intended for me in that regard.
Oh, see, the thing is, I didn't know that he was a fashion designer, so I wrote the review earlier today, and I was like, you know, maybe the LA, you know, art scene is really this, you know, vapid and stupid, but it seems like a caricature, and it reminded me of almost like Zoolander, kind of like,
yeah,
like you can't do this after Zoolander. Like, it was too thoroughly skewered. You can't put someone up there like Jenna Malone, who looked like a fucking complete dipshit. But maybe that's just, I mean, I guess maybe he's an authority. Maybe that's what it's really like.
Yeah, and I mean, and maybe like some of the emptiness of the movie itself. I mean, giving him a lot of credit could be his take on the emptiness of that art scene in general.
Yeah, and but like, I think we're in agreement that it's like way too on the nose. Both her being unhappy and just the whole world that she's in as an obvious reason why she's unhappy are just a little too on the nose. I do think that it works really well as a cool down in between the scenes of the book, which plays out with Jake Gyllenhaal playing the main character. And that was so intense. That's why I liked the movie, just almost exclusively because of the kind of story within the story.
Yeah, I really like that idea, and I really like that story, that self-contained story. But so it was kind of weird because it's a story within a movie I'm watching. It made me all the more aware that the story of Jake Gyllenhaal's character was not real.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like a lot less connection to his story because it all felt like it was playing out like just, you know, like a movie, but where I'm too aware of it being a movie.
Does that make sense? It work for you? Did it get your tummy in knots? We say tummy on this podcast.
Yeah, we say tummy. We censor ourselves in adorable ways.
Yeah. You bet your fanny. You bet your fanny we do.
Wait, so what was the question now? Did it work for me?
Did it like get your guts in knots? Like, for me, it was like kind of like not white knuckle tension, because it wasn't that kind of tension, but it was very like pit in my stomach kind of tension.
It did a little bit, but the other movie that we may get to a little bit later, Cape Fear, that was like all the way up. Like, I couldn't really take much more intensity from the movie. Whereas this one, like it was just like two steps removed from the reality, I guess, in my head of the movie.
Okay.
That it didn't hit as hard as it could have.
Man, dude, you got such a weird, like, mental framework of reality in movies. It's like, it's kind of fascinating now that we're doing this podcast how often that is, like, the benchmark that a movie either hits or misses.
Yeah. I'm also starting to realize that that's kind of my main criticism, I think, is just the reality if it works within its own context and if it feels like the real thing that I would expect. And maybe that's a bad way to go about critiquing movies, but gosh darn it, that's the way I'm doing it.
Oh yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that was kind of my whole feeling coming out of it. Like, I thought it looked great. I like the idea a lot of, you know, the story playing out within the movie and kind of affecting the characters of the movie while they're reading, I guess, the was it a novel? Yeah, it was a novel, right? It wasn't a script, was it?
No, it was a book. There was a book called like Susan and Edward or whatever, and I don't know. I didn't read the book because obviously I didn't.
Oh no, I meant the inside the movie, the one that Jake Gyllenhaal writes. It's a novel.
Yeah, it's a novel.
Yeah. The thing too, like you mentioned about the trailer being a little deceiving. I think my other problem watching the movie is the whole time I was waiting for more of a connection between the story that Jake Gyllenhaal wrote and the relationship he had with Amy Adams beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm missing some of the connections there, but I do think that now that I understand the whole movie and know what happened, I think I would like it seeing it a second time.
Yeah, I would definitely watch it a second time. I will say that my enjoyment of the movie was basically, you know, if it was at an 8, it dropped to about a 6 in the last, like, literally, like, the last 2 minutes of the movie, because, you know, obviously she's reading the whole book and then doing fuck all in her own life, so all the exciting parts of the movie are basically in the book. She's just kind of, you know, lifting little bits of, one more layer of the onion every time she has a flashback. So you get more and more sense of what her relationship with Jake Gyllenhaal was. And so it kind of keeps you moving along. And it's just, it's in between, you know, mm-hmm. great, you know, interesting thriller in the novel with Jake Gyllenhaal trying to get justice for his, you know, murdered family. And then back to Amy Adams, and she's like, oh, what was, you know, a little more about Jake. And then the novel ends, and you're like, all right, well, now the movie has to have a resolution. And the whole thing is taken like a Big Night type stance, how they're always waiting for Louis Prima the whole movie. So in a way, the whole movie feels almost like you're still in the first act, so it really moves along. But then at the end, you're like, all right, now she has to go meet Jake Gyllenhaal, and how are they going to resolve this? And she goes to the... She goes to the restaurant, and she's going to meet him there, and she's at the restaurant, and she looks up at the door, and he's not there, and then she takes a drink, looks up at the door, he's still not there, and I was like, God damn it, they better not do, like, a wide shot of the restaurant, and, like, they just keep fading out as more and more people leave, and mm-hmm. then she's, like, alone at the restaurant, and that's exactly what they did, and it just seems like you can try to play it, like, as artistically as you want, but that's essentially, to me, admitting that you don't know how to resolve this story.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Also, like, the whole movie's about revenge, and if you couldn't get that, there's a giant painting that says revenge about halfway through yeah. that she stops and looks at. Another subtle move by Tom Ford. But
yeah, and at the end of the day, what was Gyllenhaal's revenge? They wrote a good book and stood her up. It just, I don't know. It didn't. I understand they were trying to leave her. And I know there mm-hmm. are movies that have done that, that kind of just leave the person alone in their own, you know, misery. I can't think of them now, but it just really.
There's definitely been a movie to do that.
Yeah, I mean, The Social Network kind of does that, where they say at the end of it all, he still, mm-hmm. you know, wants, what's her name, Rooney Mara, to be his friend. And. But it was just like, well, that sucked. And even the conclusion of the novel where he confronts the guy who killed his wife and the guy turns out to be like a total psychopath killer. And it wasn't just kind of like something that got out of hand and like a crime of passion. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, I didn't mind some of the story of that Jake Gyllenhaal writes in the movie being a little bit more cliche because leading up to it. There's flashbacks where she's like, maybe you're not a very good writer. So it's kind of funny that the story he writes is very like cliched, although, you know, very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing I didn't want to, talking about the ending, I wrote, you know, it's all about revenge. And so what Amy Adams does to Jake Gyllenhaal is, you know, she aborts his baby. And so to get back at him, he just ghosts her on a date.
Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying.
Not very powerful revenge after all the buildup of the entire movie.
Yeah, that's what I feel like it's probably one of those movies. I saw some fucking website posted something. I was like, here's all the hidden Easter eggs in Moana. I feel like Easter eggs went from about 20 years ago being a really cool little extra bonus thing to find in a movie to almost the building blocks of a movie. Like people... in like kind of eschew like you know characters and plot. It was like, oh well, if it has enough references to the source material, then there you go. So like for instance, like at the very end of the movie, Jake Gyllenhaal, like, you know, he falls on his gun and shoots himself in the stomach, which you could say is maybe symbolic of an abortion, because it's like, you know, take it out of your guts or whatever.
I didn't really notice that he even did that.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the, I mean, it's meaningless, though. I mean, that really, so that's what I'm saying. If you have, like, a little, like, cipher in the movie and, oh, look at all these little connections, I don't think that matters. I think that really the two stories don't have too much in common, although I really love that Isla Fisher, is that how you, or Isla Fisher?
Yeah.
Plays essentially Amy Adams in his book.
Okay, yeah. Like, that was my question. I didn't know if that was supposed to be straight up, but I guess, yeah, it is. Then yeah, they're just,
I mean,
like,
it seems like
I always confuse them.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, oh, that's perfect casting. I did have some niggling details, if I could get into those.
Sure.
One, and we're on brand here, the hair. A year after the incident, Jake Gyllenhaal has to, facially recognize in part of a lineup, you know, his perpetrators. They have the exact same hair as they had on that night. It's like, come on. And who at like 20-ish years old has the same hair a year later?
Yeah, same facial hair too.
Yeah, the same like wispy mustache. It's like, give me a break. He's either going to have a full mustache or he's going to be just clean shaven. Make it a little like, oh, is that the same guy? Yes, it is.
Yeah, I honestly think I noticed that and I thought of you.
Yeah, there you go.
Now I'm noticing that more. Because Jake Gyllenhaal does shave his beard.
He shaves his beard. He also has slightly different hair in the book as he does in the flashbacks. He has like shorter hair in the flashbacks.
Yeah, I mean, he's generally more clean cut.
Yeah, so it's like, all right, that works. And Amy Adams' hair is different in the flashbacks than in reality. And there's even some awareness, it seems, on Tom Ford's part that her hair speaks to her character. It's a lot more free, flowing in the flashbacks, and it's very straight and, you know, strapped down hair.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone does that. Everyone knows that trick. Another detail. So Amy Adams has a daughter who seems to be about 20, but she aborted Jake Gyllenhaal's daughter about 20 years ago. So
I didn't quite get the timelines of
that. Was a confusing timeline for me
because they changed the hair, but it's like Amy Adams is supposed to be in college when she's meeting with her mom. But then I didn't really know how much later she's supposed to be living in LA as an artist.
It was supposed to be 20 years, I think she's, or 19 years or something.
Oh, but okay. I missed that.
It doesn't give a lot of time for that girl to not be too young to do a full nude of her. And she seems like she's away at college too. Like she's away. Just she calls, the mom calls, and she's like not at home. She doesn't live at home anymore. So, yeah.
And they don't like she would talk be very often.
Yeah, so it seems like she'd be at least 18. So it's like, what, she like aborted the kid and then just got pregnant right away with Armie Hammer's kid? Armie Hammer sucks, by the way. He's like the
He sucks.
He's like if you did a duplicate, like you tried to clone Michael Fassbender, but like none of the talent came through. It was like just an empty body.
If you tried to clone Michael Fassbender, but then added the super soldier serum from Captain America, then you get Armie Hammer.
Yeah. If you took basically Michael Fassbender's DNA and like impregnated it into a beefcake, and then
like a
Chippendales dancer or something, or yeah, just a literal London broil, it would grow into Armie Hammer. And I think he was fine in this role just because he's supposed to be like a vacant douchebag. But, I mean, everyone else in this movie was super good, I would say.
Yeah, super duper good.
I mean, Michael Shannon.
Yeah, I haven't even mentioned him yet.
Good God. He's my favorite part. I mean, he's very fun. He made me laugh a lot, like, especially when the guy, Jake Gyllenhaal asks, are you going to choke for this? Because they decide to just like do an extrajudicial murder on the suspects that are going to get away. He's like, I don't give a shit. I'm going to die in a year.
Yeah, he was the only levity in the movie. It was
a real dark levity, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it worked within the movie really well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's nothing better than a guy with nothing to lose, played by Michael Shannon.
Yeah. Yeah, his whole, like, corrupt, or I guess cynical lawman and, like, this the random wanton violence in the Texas setting reminded me a bit of No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
It could exist in the same universe.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. I was trying to think of another... I thought I had another connection to make, but...
Like Hell or High Water?
It's escaped me. Yeah, a little bit Hell or High Water. A lot of, I feel like Texas is getting hot in the movies.
Yeah, is Texas the new Boston?
I think so. Yeah,
Boston. Thank God, Boston. Fucking Christ. Get over yourself, Boston. Set a movie in fucking Pittsburgh or something if you want like a white middle class, you know, trailer trash folks.
But then you don't get the wicked hardcore accents. Yeah, they go to UT also in the movie. Gotta shout that out. Yeah, I think Jake Gyllenhaal goes to UT. Yeah, she's going to Columbia or some bullshit.
Yeah, I think she went to UT and then was getting her master's in Columbia. Which is like, ooh, what a change. Amy Adams has an abortion and she's like in the car, kind of like crying about it, like, abortions are bad. Why'd I do this? And Army Hammer's like, don't worry, he's never gonna find out about it. And they look up and Jake Gyllenhaal's just like there in the rain, like, and like, why would you be at the abortion clinic unless you already knew?
Yeah,
like, just pass it on your way to work. And even if you did, how would you even know what the point of it was? Like, they're sitting in a car near an abortion clinic.
Yeah, that was really weird. And made especially funny just because they're like, he's never going to find out. He's a million miles away. He's right behind me.
Yeah, it's like, blah. Yeah, that was absolutely dumb. That was maybe the dumbest thing. Maybe the second dumbest. There's another one. But anyway, what are you saying?
Well, I was going to say that scene even has really bad writing too, because she's just like, I think I'm going to regret this. It's like, okay, yeah.
Yeah. This is the bad thing we were referencing earlier that I did to him.
A good scene, I'll say the whole car scene was probably the most, the tensest moment.
The first one on the freeway?
I think it was supposed to be the tensest, but...
Oh, yeah.
There was good tension there. Although, I will say, I feel like it played out a little bit too long, maybe.
But I think... It was tense. That's the scene that I definitely think people shouldn't see the trailer, because not knowing the outcome of that is like, obviously there are two women there. At one point, Aaron Taylor Johnson's character starts rubbing his dick and then he's like, oh Jesus, no.
Yeah. That really turns my stomach.
They played it really well though with, kind of a constant, like the nocturnal animals, the nocturnal boys, who are kind of preying upon this family. They kind of keep, breaking the tension with a little levity and then turning it back into, like, they did a really good job of constantly implicating Jake Gyllenhaal anytime he stepped outside of, like, the rules that they set for that encounter.
Yeah.
And kind of turned it back on him. And that's kind of what really, for me, put a pit in my stomach, was just this constant kind of shoving his face further in the mud and blaming him for it. And he's such a pussy. That whole scene is just like, Jesus Christ, guy.
Yeah. The scenes like that really, really get to me. Cause it's a scene where someone's trying to be rational in an irrational situation. And I just have like a rational fear that I'll get myself into a situation like that and try to be like, hey, cooler heads will prevail. Oh god, these guys are not gonna be cool.
Yeah, so that's pretty rough. And I thought that was really fantastic, and I think that's why I liked the cutting back to boring old LA, because it kind of gives you a little bit of a rest.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, yeah, it does, but I was still like, the whole time I think my mind was just like, how is this connecting? Like, Isla Fisher is Amy Adams. So I guess the daughter is the aborted baby. I wasn't quite sure on that.
The whole thing though had me going, just because of how, I was always like, all right, Michael Shannon has cancer. He's going to like, collapse, and that's going to leave pussy Jake Gyllenhaal with these two guys who are now unhandcuffed, and he've already stated he's going to kill them, so they're just going to jump him. And anyway, the other stupidest thing was right after Michael Shannon kills the one guy with the wispy pube mustache, the main guy runs off, and Jake Gyllenhaal follows him in the car. And when he finds him, he's just like sleeping in a cabin,
like a mile away.
Yeah,
like the only cabin that they would know that Jake Gyllenhaal would be aware of.
Yeah, so it was a little like, I'm not sure that would, like, even if he wanted to sleep, like, he definitely just ran away from someone shooting at him. And well, that's he must know he's being hunted.
Yeah, and that's another example, though, of it. I mean, maybe, again, I'm, like, giving too much credit, but it's the story written by Jake Gyllenhaal, who's, like, an incredible pussy in the movie and probably a bad writer.
Yeah.
So he's, like, writing it for himself to kind of work through his weakness. And so,
yeah, you kind of see the, like, the symbolism of it.
Yeah, and he's also bending it all in his favor.
Yeah.
But yeah, from like a movie standpoint, it's like, yeah, why is he sleeping? But he also has a crowbar under his pillow. So like he kind of
yeah, he's ready.
He's ready, but not ready because he's sleeping.
Yeah.
And like, anyway, didn't even set a Home Alone trap or anything.
Yeah. Well, on the whole, I liked it. I would recommend people see it. It wasn't what they play it out to be in the marketing, which they definitely played out to be like Crazy X, Cape Fear type, you know, setup. And that's why we paired it with Cape Fear before watching the movie.
Yeah. I would say if you could somehow watch it without watching the trailers, although also why would you be listening to this podcast if we just spoiled the whole thing? But
yeah, that's true.
If I well, could let's just move send on that, yeah, if I could just send that mental force out there for someone to pick up. But let's move on.
Yeah, so on to a movie that we also saw. This is a first time viewing for both of us, right? Cape Fear?
Correct. Amundo.
Scorsese and De Niro back at it again. I always think of Raging Bull, Goodfellas, and Casino, and I never think of Cape Fear. I guess because I hadn't seen Cape Fear.
Yeah.
I'd seen it like as a kid, like parts of it, but not enough. But this, you said, had it was intense, the whole shebang, the whole shaboodle.
Yeah. This is like, I can't really imagine you doing like a more tense version of this kind of movie. It's just insane from the get-go. I mean,
did you find it hard to watch though after like already having seen like the Simpsons parody and just kind of it being a culturally known thing?
I didn't really, because honestly I kind of forgot about the Simpsons trailer until I was already like deep into the movie, so it didn't really affect me. Although I was like, man, where have I heard this music before?
Yeah.
And it was definitely from that Simpsons parody.
Yeah, I think they use the exact same score, unless they just do a really good job of copying it.
I think they might. I think they just like highlight one little riff really well. Or maybe they just take the score, I don't know. So I didn't really know much about this movie at all coming into
it. Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah. It was kind of my wife's suggestion because she'd seen it when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
Like way too young to watch this movie.
And, yeah.
Then she kind of, I guess, wanted to maybe like watch it again to see what, if it was really as scary as she remembered. And then she fell asleep, but that's fine.
See, I wish I watched it properly now, because I watched it, I was playing Dark Souls, and I put it on, and I'm like, once it grabs me, then I'll watch the rest of it. So probably like the second and third act I watched just kind of solo, but I was kind of watching the other one, like, you know, as while goofing around.
Yeah, and I think it does a really good job at jumping straight up. I mean, right from the get-go, you see crazy fucking Bobby De Niro covered in really scary tats.
Yeah, sweet tats, though.
Yeah.
I want that one with the clown and the revolver.
I don't remember exactly that one, but I remember there being a clown, and that was like the only one that looked weird.
Yeah.
It was like poorly done. And like his back tattoo with the scales of justice is like so detailed and freaking scary. Yeah. In the world of, I should have prompted this before, but you know, there's a trend of like scary back tattoos in movies. I'm thinking like, yeah, Red Dragon. This has to rank up there.
Eastern Promises, Vigo has some badass Russian mafia tattoos.
But yeah, the scales of justice has to be pretty high up there.
Yeah.
We'll do a list of best back tats soon.
That's, I think that's a good idea. But this one was Scorsese, and it's written by Wesley Strick, and it's a remake of a Gregory Peck film.
Mm-hmm. Which I also did not know.
Yeah, I didn't either. So I thought that The Departed was his first like remake. But the plot's just that a recently released convict harasses the fuck out of a lawyer who did a shitty job defending him from a rape trial.
Mm-hmm. Convict played by Robert De Niro, lawyer played by Nick Nolte.
What a twist. I mean, you think of it today, you'd be like, oh, definitely Nick Nolte's playing the insane psychopathic killer.
Yeah, to be honest,
although
I don't
Bobby
know.
De Niro would have been probably a shitty straight man.
He wouldn't have played like a scared lawyer very well because he's just
no.
so intense.
I thought Nick Nolte actually did a pretty good job.
I thought he was great.
Of being kind of like the asshole dad who's just trying to keep his life together.
Yeah, like he was really good at being like doing like the slow unravel and like trying to keep a cool head at the beginning, and then he lets it get to him and he goes nuts himself by the end. I don't really know too many movies I've seen of Nick Nolte like before I knew he was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So this was a real revelation to me. He's an excellent actor.
Yeah, it also made me realize that you could get do a good movie with Nick Nolte as old Nick Nolte and young Nick Nolte played by our buddy Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin. I literally said the same thing while watching this movie. We're in step right now.
Don't even have to record the podcast.
Oh, fuck. I'm not recording.
I will say also that Juliette Lewis makes a great daughter for Jessica Lange. Lange? Ling? Lange?
Lang. Language. Language. It just
Lang
looks...
lady. Yeah, she really looks like she could be her daughter.
Okay, yeah. I can see that.
And I'm glad they got someone slightly ugly who kind of still looks like a kid.
Yeah, she plays a good dumb kid well.
Yeah, although, like Jesus Christ, did they have to do that scene with Robert De Niro's thumb in her mouth and then he like kisses her straight on the mouth?
The theater scene, I had to look away because I didn't know what was going to happen. I was like, I can't watch what I think is going to happen. So I was just like on my phone that whole scene.
For me, it was kind of one of those things that made me kind of sick, not just from in the movie, but just... You know, because it's not like they just film movies in The Matrix and it's all fake. It's like Robert De Niro really had to put his thumb in this girl's mouth, mm-hmm. who really does look 15, and then kiss her on the mouth. It's like, mm-hmm. it's like that's, and apparently that, I looked it up, apparently that scene was largely improvised. So it's like, it's just very bizarre to me. And yeah. So I could have done without that. I did think... No, I'm kind of blaming myself now for not watching it, you know, clear-headed from the get-go.
Good job.
But on the other hand, I actually kind of think I'd like to watch it high instead, because maybe it would kind of, like, help strip away all of the, like, residual knowledge I have, and let me just watch it for what it is.
So you do, like, a Men in Black mind wipe?
Yeah, I mean, I just movies I've seen before are just kind of like have a... it kind of reminded me of watching like A Nightmare on Elm Street, which once you see like the Simpsons parody, you kind of already know right. the beats. And so I found myself kind of waiting the whole movie for them to get on the houseboat because I already knew that happened anyway, just from... I don't know if I'd seen it before. So like the actual playing out of the movie to me, it kind of seemed like it was maybe drawn out, which... kind of ironic because that was like the Simpsons parody was so short that they had to like pad it with like that rake scene, like extending it out just because they weren't meeting like the necessary runtime. But
that's funny.
This one seemed a little long. I felt like they like scenes like where he meets Jessica Lange and hands her the dog collar, it just felt like not necessary. And at some point he's just kind of like flitting in and out of their life so much that it almost seems like it could almost be a comedy. Like a What About Bob kind of thing, because like he's constantly annoying this guy, but the guy keeps trying to appeal to like the authorities and they're like, whoa, no one but you can tell that he's an asshole.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. I didn't mind the pacing. I liked that it was slow revenge because it was something kind of different from what you're used to, where it's like the guy's just going to come out and just like fuck up his life and do it in like a really extreme way. That you couldn't not have the authorities involved, but he did it like so slowly and very subtly at some point that it kind of made sense that like, well, you know, we kind of have to see how it plays out because there's not really anything like hard.
Yeah, although, it was just kind of hard. It was hard to get his, to get like what his goal was. Cause I mean, he's obviously like a hyper competent guy on a goal to, fuck this guy's life up, and it's just I don't know. I mean, I felt like parts of it went a little too smoothly, like him.
Yeah, it all went very smoothly, but I didn't mind it. I mean, the context of the character Robert De Niro is he's been in jail for 14 years, pretty much waiting for this moment. Like, he's tried to get out. He's found out the ways that Nick Nolte screwed him over for his defense. So he's like been savoring this. So he's not going to want to rush it. And also, he's been studying law so much in the clink that he, you can make the connection that he'd be smart enough to know how he could get around, you know, blowing his load too quickly on his revenge and throwing back in jail.
Yeah, but what got me like he seduces the guy's girlfriend, the woman from Goodfellas, I forget her name. And rapes her and like breaks her arm and bites her face, like confident that she's not going to testify. And it's like, well, you don't even have to charge him with rape. You just charge him with biting your face and breaking your arm. This isn't like a date rape scenario where it's like, oh, was her skirt too short? It's like, I mean, it kind of doesn't matter if you're drunk, if someone bites your face off and breaks your, you know, limbs. So,
but she was right in thinking that all that shit would get drug up anyway by the defense.
Yeah, I mean, it could have, but I'm just saying, it just seems like it feels like you could just as easily, I mean, unless he knew her super well, say that someone who's got experience in it would know how to just bury him on that and, you know, avoid those pitfalls. So it seemed convenient for him.
That was a little convenient. Even finding her and, like, hooking up with her seemed kind of like, wait, is this really, was it that easy? Like, was he even planning to do this, or did it just, like, happen?
Yeah, the guy just canceled his date with her, and then the other guy showed up. And that's what I'm saying. That's how it kind of, like, and then he seduces the daughter. And it's like, well, I mean, you kind of know that this guy killed your dog. And I know he denied it, but I don't know. It's just a little odd. And so it is just almost this case where, like, you know, Nick Nolte's character is, like, kind of the only sane man who sees that this guy's harassing him, and everyone else is just like, oh, he seems like a pretty nice guy. It's fine. Like, why didn't Nick Nolte tell his daughter that, like, he flips out on her, which I think was a good scene. And I think generally his mental breakdown was really good, especially, you know, with the wife and everything. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of like, I mean, you could just tell the daughter, hey, he was convicted of rape, so, like, he's not cool.
Yeah, and they have that, there's like a line in there where they confront Nick Nolte, his wife and daughter, like, why he didn't tell them. And he's just like, oh, I didn't want to, I guess, expose you to that stuff.
I don't want to ruin the pacing of the film. Also, they don't reveal how he keeps getting into the house, and that pissed me off, because I'm like, there's some, like, secret that he's getting in without, you know, Jodan Baker, figuring it out. And it's like, how's he doing it? Like, you got to show me.
Yeah, and it is annoying, because there's that scene where Nick Nolte wakes up. He has the vision of seeing Bobby De Niro in his bedroom. And he's like, I know how he killed the dog. But then he doesn't really go anywhere with that.
Yeah, he's just like, oh, he got into the house and killed the dog. Oh, okay.
We knew that.
He, like, he kills the house, the maid, and, like, dresses up in her clothes. And, like, it's kind of convenient that the guy, like, walks in and, like, doesn't really look at her much and, like, just sits with his back to her.
Yeah, yeah, that was a little convenient.
Yeah, apparently, I think it was Steven Spielberg's idea for him to kill the guy while dressed as the maid. I was like, yeah, fuck you, Steven Spielberg.
He would. He would.
Fucking child.
Shit, I had a point. Oh, well, what did you think of some of, like, the weird directing stuff that Scorsese was doing in the beginning there?
Like the negative. Like the blacklight stuff? The negatives, yeah. I thought that was pretty cool, actually.
Scene, and then the double focus when him brushing his teeth.
Yeah, I think that, honestly, I thought about that, and I was like, you know, I wonder if knowing it was Scorsese kind of raised my expectations, and I would have enjoyed it more if I just seen it randomly and not known who made it, because, I mean, those expectations are there.
To counter that, I think knowing it's Scorsese puts some of those things in the light of, like, a director that I like. So it's like, oh, this is a good decision.
Oh, yeah. So you have to think about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, just what I was talking about, Tom Ford, like, I was kind of coming into it skeptical of him. So all the choices he made, I was like, I don't know about this Tom Ford.
Yeah. I did say that De Niro's accent weirded me out a bit. Like when he had the first scene with the keys and he's talking like that, I'm like, is he joking or is that like the voice he's going to do the whole movie?
Yeah.
And it kind of...
Yeah.
At times he like settled into it and it worked really well, but other times it was like really off and it kind of took me out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like when he's walking out of the jail, he's like, I don't need that. I'm already done with it. It's like, what the fuck? Yeah. I think that's the first time he speaks, and it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, maybe he's the one who taught Andrew Garfield how to do Southern accents.
Yeah, he fucking sure taught him how to do an Italian accent.
I mean, there were times when he really settled into it really well, and it worked for me. And he kind of, like, ceased to be Robert De Niro, and that's really hard to do. I was thinking about that while watching Nocturnal Animals, because we talked going into it about how we like Amy Adams and we like Jake Gyllenhaal, but at some point I feel like, you know, at what point does an actor's familiarity kind of supersede their skill? And so even though they might still be really good, you've seen them in too many things. So it's like, they've kind of reached a dead end where they have to either step their game up or take a break from acting. And I think De Niro really ran into that problem, you know, strong by like the late 90s. And now it's like you're
two decades.
It's really hard to not see Robert De Niro. And I don't think that he's doing a great job in most of his stuff anyway, but it is one of those things that's like, you know, the more familiar an actor is, unless they're a guy like Tom Cruise, who you never really see them as anything but Tom Cruise. And you know, that way it's all about the intensity. So it doesn't matter. But someone like Johnny Depp, who, you know, really like to play kind of a different type of character, eventually it's just like, all right, I'm fucking annoyed at Johnny Depp. Like, I can't see him as anything but Johnny Depp doing a stupid voice, so just get out of here, Johnny Depp.
Yeah, and that's back to Andrew Garfield, kind of the territory he's stepping on right now.
Yeah, he's not careful. Even that familiar though.
I mean, I guess he is to me.
His familiarity recently. Maybe overtook his talent just earlier, because he had just not as talented.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But
it's possibly like really good in either of those movies, though, too.
That's true. We're basing this on 5 minutes of trailers. But I think we're pretty close.
We're
good at our jobs.
By that.
I'll agree with you, though. I would say by about halfway through, I wasn't really seeing Bobby De Niro too much.
Yeah.
I was just saying it's freaking psycho. One of the scariest villains I think I've ever seen.
Like I did see him as like the lead singer of AC/DC too often, because he had that like kind of curly hair and that stupid hat.
Was he wearing like a captain's hat?
No, yeah, he was wearing like a cabbie hat or whatever.
Cabbie hat, yeah.
And like 80s t-shirts or button-ups.
I did really like the scene where Nick Nolte is like the first time he's trying to like get rid of him. He's offering him money. And then Bobby De Niro's in like his Cadillac or whatever with his shitty Hawaiian shirt and hat on. He's like, does it look like I need money?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, it kind of does, buddy.
Yeah. Well, I did like think you're blowing through it. It kind of worked the same way Nocturnal Animals tension worked, in that, you know, Nick Nolte kept kind of implicating himself. So like,
yeah.
You almost feel like if he had an ironclad, and same with Jake Gyllenhaal, like an ironclad commitment to his own values, that maybe he could get out of it. But the fact that he does eventually try to cheat, then is like, uh-oh, now you've just kind of given this guy, you know, I mean, obviously the guy's going to do whatever the fuck he wants anyway. But the feeling is that you've just given him more access. You know, you've just ceded more territory to him, because now you're saying, oh, it's okay to, you know, to talk outside of the law and I'm going to pay you off. It's okay to, then he hires the guys to beat him up. And it's like, well, now you're absolutely like all bets are off.
Mm-hmm. And I really took that as like a changing moment for Bobby's De Niro's character. Like I kind of thought maybe he was just going to continue on the path of just trying to like drive Nick Nolte crazy and break up his marriage maybe. But
oh, just harass him?
Yeah, like I didn't really, the path he was on, I didn't think that he would maybe go down the down to like extreme violence or murder. But then, yeah, once Nick Nolte came at him with guns blazing, he's, yeah, that like pissed off.
Well, I mean, Bobby, he did already much. Violently rape his girlfriend and kill his dog.
That's true. I forgot.
So he was kind of on that trajectory already, I think.
Yeah, it did seem like it kind of pressed the fast forward button a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely. I mean, he declared war at that point, and whether or not the guy was, you know, about to march on him anyway, at that point, it was like, hey, war's declared.
War were declared.
Did you feel like at some point he should have been like, is Jodan Baker really that good? Like, why am I putting all this faith into this guy who fucked up that very simple hit job?
Yeah. And drinks bourbon and Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I've got this. I've got this teddy bear system of figuring out who's in the house. It's like, maybe do you get a second opinion on this? There's got to be more bounty hunters in town.
Yeah. Also, like, that system requires you to sit and stare at a teddy bear for, what, 72 hours straight?
Yeah.
I don't know if I believe that. You got to get up to poop at some point.
Yeah. It's like, why don't you get a bell? Like, bells work, right?
Yeah, or like they had security cameras back then, right?
Yeah.
Like motion lights or something?
1991.
Yeah, motion detection, something, I don't know.
Yeah, you'd think just get cameras on every view of the house, and that way you just know where he is instead of, I mean, the bear's more cinematic, but come on, you fuckhead.
Yeah, it didn't even
the
work.
The conclusion, how'd you feel about the conclusion of the movie?
You just mean the whole, like, them the getting boat. To the boat? Well, first off, what did you think about Bobby De Niro hiding under the car?
For, like, hours?
Could have been hundreds of miles.
Yeah, I thought that was a little weird. Again, you know, you watch The Simpsons, you kind of, the sideshow Bob under the car, and he's getting hit by speed bumps and whatnot. But, yeah, it was a little... Like, the best. This guy could definitely fuck himself up like this.
Yeah, and also, like, I mean, I know it was, say, the audience could see him, but he was pretty obviously under the car.
Yeah.
Like, anyone, they're driving out of the gas station, and it looks like there's a guy walking to his car who notices him.
Yeah, so it's a little odd.
Very weird, but whatever.
What if he had to pee?
Dude, he's
trying. I think
himself.
Actually, he goes straight to a bathroom right after he gets out from under the car.
Yeah, that's true, to clean up a little bit. But
yeah, that was a little off. But the full ending with the houseboat, it was weird because it's
so friggin' crazy.
Well, it's not really fair to Scorsese, but I feel like since then, Edgar Wright has made swoop noises, very comedic. So every time De Niro's like swoops his gun, he's like, whoop, whoop. I was like, well, now this is kind of goofy, especially that he's trying to get like a court system going, like he's pretending he's in court at the end.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was trying to think of what you were talking about. I don't remember the swoosh noise, but yeah, the camera is like is it the gun point of view, and it's like swoosh swoosh back and forth.
Yeah, and then like he's looking back at the wife as she's, you know, saying something. He's like, oh no, he was being argumentative, and it's like almost not quite a fisheye lens, but just kind of, I don't know what millimeter it was, but it kind of looked goofy.
Yeah, and he looks back at like the judge, which isn't there. Yeah, it was a little goofy, a little silly. Like the movie's got a lot of like cheese to it.
Yeah, especially like then at the end, like the whole boat breaks apart, and he's like, you know, cuffed to it, and they wash up on shore, and they start like bashing each other with rocks. And it's just like, why is this movie so long? Like, why can't they end this? It's like the kind of the comedy of the early part where this guy can't just rid himself of this annoying dude. It kind of plays into the end too, where it's just like, this guy's just kind of a fucking, you know, a zit that won't pop.
The best was, yeah, they're fighting with the rocks, and then Nick Nolte is finally about to crush his head with a boulder, and then like a wave comes and washes Bob De Niro away, and then he's sinking in the middle of the river, and then for a second I thought he was gonna stop with his head above the water, and just stay like that.
Just that would be him the rest of the movie.
Yeah, not drown for like 20 minutes and just be sitting there heckling Nick Nolte.
Yes, he just tried to chuck rock after rock at him.
Yeah, like the knight in Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
Yeah. Yeah, and even, like, I really liked that the girl was kind of the one to do him in with the lighter fluid. But then, like, he came back almost like a monster movie monster. And his burns are all, like, suddenly, like, six-month-old healed burns.
yeah.
So, I don't know.
He jumped in the water, and water fixes everything.
Flesh would still be, like, red and, like, like, burnt.
It was a little silly, too, like, the lighter fluid. Like, how did she know he was going to light a cigar? And
pretty well, she had matches. Lucky. She might have thought of something. Yeah, that was lucky, but...
Yeah, that's true.
But she did have matches, so she could have figured something out. I don't know. I mean, why didn't she just strike a match at any point and spray the stuff at him?
Yeah.
I mean, who cares?
I thought she was going to get the gun and shoot him.
Yeah.
Because they...
That was kind of... That was kind of interesting that the gun didn't come back into play. That was kind of clever in a way, because you kind of assume, oh, the gun is the lethal weapon here. That's got to be what ends it, and then it just totally doesn't.
The MacGuffin, as I learned last time.
Ooh.
Ooh,
you know what MacGuffins are?
Yeah, I just kind of forgot. You cemented it in my brain. No, I won't forget.
Were we talking about MacGuffins?
Sorry. I was... I was just editing the Incredibles pod for Asterix R, and we talked about the MacGuffin at the end of that.
Was that podcast good at all, by the way?
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, it's fantastic. Good.
Longer than I want it to be, but that's fine.
Was it like 2 hours?
Yeah, shade under 2 hours.
Nice. But that's, it's just kind of like our Spider-Man like. 2 one was a shade under 3 hours.
But yeah, the whole end I thought was pretty tense. The I like where Bobby De Niro ties up Nick Nolte, and they don't really know where he is. And then the reveal is he's outside the window having to watch his wife get attacked. Ooh. God, it's so horrible.
Yeah, the guy was sucking on her titty pretty hard.
Yeah, I didn't like that. Could have done without that.
Yeah, yeah. That is, I mean, you know, who really likes to see that in a movie? But I guess if you know it makes you squirm, maybe it's good. In a thriller?
Yeah.
Thriller's going to make you squirm. How good was Jessica Lange, by the way?
Yeah, she's super solid.
That lady can act.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of the podcast.
who knew?
We've been on her boat since we did those American Horror Story riff tracks. Mm,
that's right.
3 years ago or something.
Where she was the only redeeming quality.
Yeah, the only redeeming quality of season one. Well, the girl with Downs was also good.
Right. But then, spoiler, they have to get rid of her like 2 episodes in.
Yeah, that was weak. But that's when we stopped watching it, too. Like, we did, that's I think, true. 4 episodes. So I guess,
yeah, and I guess the girl with Down syndrome was actually the best part.
Yeah, so once she was out, we were out. Did you want to say anything about the similarities or differences between this and the remake?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I find this stuff interesting, but probably isn't very interesting. So
nobody else does.
This is a remake of the 1962 film of the same name that stars Gregory Peck, which makes sense because Gregory Peck makes a weird cameo in the 1999 version.
Yeah, kind of like a too obvious or a too prominent cameo where he plays like an old like Colonel Sanders lawyer.
Well, they even make a reference before that to what's that movie he's in where he's a lawyer or that TV show?
The To Kill a Mockingbird?
No, he's in I'm going to find it here.
Matlock?
Matlock. Isn't he Matlock?
He's not in Matlock.
No, he's the other guy then. Whatever. They make a reference like right before that scene to Gregory Peck's like characters, and then it was weird because then he shows up as a lawyer.
Yeah,
but yeah, he was the lead character of the 1962 version.
Have we even gotten to the first similarity, or did we just get hung up on Gregory Peck?
Well, you couldn't think of the thing I was trying to think of. I mean, that's a big part. That's a big connection between the original.
Also, I like Gregory Peck.
Yeah, cool. You're really helping push this along. I love it. You complain about the lack of pace, but then you do everything you can to impede it.
I'm just pulling a Max Cady on you. I'm just fucking you up, fucking the whole podcast up.
The original Max Cady is also in the remake. Robert Mitchum. He's the guy with a really weird looking face.
Yeah, quality what face though. Face. Quality movie so, face.
Yeah, solid movie face. So the original, the lawyer, he doesn't bury evidence against Cady. He actually testifies against him because he's the one that witnessed the attack of Cady on the woman.
Mm-hmm.
So it really changes the dynamic completely because it's like, it's really, I guess, more apparent to everybody why the Cady would be after the lawyer.
Yeah, I did like this version better though because it's it kind of implicates Nolte a bit.
Yeah, and it gives reason for why he wouldn't push too hard at the end because he just wants to kind of like get rid of it.
Yeah,
because
quietly.
He doesn't want to reveal that. Yeah, he buried evidence, which would get him disbarred as a lawyer probably.
I did think it was kind of gross that like the evidence that he buried was just like that the woman was promiscuous, which is just like, I mean, I guess it's good because it makes you kind of sympathize with Nolte for burying it, like even though professionally he shouldn't. But it's like,
right.
That's a really disgusting defense to use in a rape trial.
Yeah, but it does also play into the context of when Cady attacks the girlfriend, why she won't testify because she knows stuff like that will come up.
Anyway, so, what else we got?
The woman that I was talking about that Cady attacks, it's not Sam's side piece. It's actually the private eye he detects, or he hires his side piece. So it's another kind of, I think they did that better again in the new one, like having it a lot hit closer to home.
Yeah, although I was hoping that at some point, especially after like the beat up goes poorly, and like when Jodan Baker suggests that the guy get the gun, he then stops him and he's like, oh no, what if you're too big of a pussy to use the gun? But what I thought he was gonna say is, maybe I'm getting in too deep on this and I don't want to be connected to whatever happens between you and this guy, you know? So I was kind of hoping for more of maybe some type of conflict to arise between, you know, Nick Nolte, who's desperate, and Jodan Baker, who doesn't want to get his hands too dirty.
Yeah, not to spoil later, but I feel like Jodan Baker probably could have been a good nominee for Hardest Man if he didn't get his ass killed. he's like a private eye. He's not even a cop, but he's got like full confidence that he will somehow not get implicated for just randomly killing this guy.
Yeah, he also sucks dick at his job. He gets made incredibly quickly. He hires like four jagoffs to pull like a rough job on Cady, who are all soft cocks and get their asses kicked. And then he uses a teddy bear as a surveillance system and gets fucking murdered as he's like got his back to a maid.
Yeah, he's just like dicking off, even though the whole time they're supposed to be like super tense waiting for this guy. But he's like, I'll walk away from the teddy bear for about 10 minutes to
take a little drink.
One of the other differences, so that I don't know if that whole teddy bear scene even happens in the original, but the kind of the
not.
Plan. Yeah, it's only good enough for one movie. The plan in the original is to have the family go to the houseboat, but the lawyer, Sam, make it look like he's not with them so that he can lure Cady to, you know, attack his wife and daughter, but then surprise and kill him with the help of a police deputy. So they kind of make reference to that in the 91 Scorsese version, where I think Robert Mitchum tells him to use his family as bait.
And he's like, that's a stupid fucking idea. Nobody would do that. What a dumb idea.
But in the other one, that doesn't work, obviously. And then the other one, another thing I think that did better in the Scorsese version, at the very end, it kind of plays out the same, and Sam and Cady come to, you know, one epic fight at the end. But instead of killing him, Sam, the lawyer, decides to let Cady live because he thinks it's better that he'd spend a life in jail.
No, way to spoil that movie then. I didn't see that one yet. I actually think that's a better version.
You do?
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I like the the idea that this guy's been pushed like beyond a breaking point, that like he can never come back, that he was, you know, about to kill this man, and that he's now like completely, I mean, despite everything else also, like totally ruined and changed.
Yeah, maybe. I think that works for Nick Nolte's character because he's more implicated, whereas this guy, the Gregory Peck version, is a man of the law, and, you know, the guy's coming after him just for doing the law normal-wise. So I'm fine
with
him letting him live.
Yeah, in that version, yeah. I thought you meant, like, applying that to this version, because then you'd be wrong.
So do you want to do Hardest Man? Is there any doubt about that across all the movies?
Well, what's yours? Maybe there is.
I mean, fucking Robert De Niro is the hardest man, obviously. The guys are beating the fuck out of him with, like, lead pipes, and he kicks the shit out of all three of them. And then he gets set on fire and comes back for more.
Yeah, in that sense, I would agree, but my hardest man, I think, also needs to have a little bit of honor. Okay. Nothing's harder than honor. And so I think Michael Shannon is my hardest man.
Michael Shannon has no honor. He goes out of his way to commit murders outside of the law while using his privilege as a sheriff to like round up these guys.
But they're murders in revenge.
Yeah, I won't disagree with him being extremely hard, though, because he, as soon as he finds out he has cancer, he gives less than a fuck about anything. And he's just out to get like natural justice.
Yeah, and he doesn't even really do his job very well anymore. Like, I think they have a line in there where they talk about how he, like, they couldn't actually bring these guys to court because Michael Shannon fucked up the investigation so much because he wants results.
Yeah, well, I mean, even the way that he took the guy Ray Marcus in, like, as he's on the shitter outside of his house, and they just, like, drives around with him, like, uncuffed with the victim in the car. It's just like, this seems highly irregular.
And highly hard.
yeah. Definitely that's going to be, he's a pretty hard man. Do we have any corrections from Oldboy? I feel like we should have had some like corrections of like mistaking some Korean culture or pronunciation or something.
Yeah, there was actually too many to even list.
So
for the
sake
of brevity.
Yeah,
we've skipped those. We're skipping all corrections and omissions and going to everyone's new favorite section, fuck yous.
All right, let's get some fuck yous in there.
First fuck you goes to Steven Spielberg for being too much of a pussy to remake Old Boy in its original hard form.
An original script?
No, I'm sorry, the hardest form, which is the Park Chan-wook version. He wanted to do it based more on the manga, which was undoubtedly much softer.
Oh, Jesus, Spielberg.
So he gets the first fuck you. Second fuck you goes to Spike Lee for remaking the movie at all and doing a fucking terrible job and perpetuating the idea that remakes are worthless unless you can say something interesting, which apparently he could not do.
Well, we didn't see that, though, so maybe that was fine.
No, it sucked. There's no way it didn't suck.
Oh, I kind of feel like we should see it. Anyway.
Right. Well, still, he still perpetuates the idea that remakes suck, because everyone just thinks that movie sucks, even with
all We'll have to see if we can vindicate him or further implicate him with a second fuck you for the same slight.
Yeah, he might get the rare double fuck you if it turns out to be shitty.
Speaking of rare double fuck you.
Yes, we have one right now. Double fuck you to Steven Spielberg for, again, being too much of a pussy to remake Cape Fear. He passed it off to Scorsese, like the soft, flaccid wang he is.
And what would make it almost impossible to not see it as like a comedy of What About Bob proportions, he actually was interested in having Bill Murray play Katie.
Jesus.
I do think that him handing it off to Scorsese had something to do with Scorsese had the go-ahead to do what's it called?
Schindler's List.
And that he suggested that a Jewish director should do Schindler's List. So he was like, well, even though I'm fucking awesome, I guess I'll do like a really commercial film that someone like Steven Spielberg really should be doing. And I'll let Spielberg do Schindler's List, a movie that definitely I should be doing.
Yeah, I like how they just like straight up traded.
Yeah.
Then I guess Spielberg got the better end of that trade.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's hard to beat the... I mean, I think that that's in some ways the biggest feather in his cap as far as, oh, I'm not just about like popcorn movies. I guess he did Munich eventually, but, and Saving Private Ryan later, but I mean, for a while, I mean, that was kind of like the thing that was like, all right, let's get serious.
Yeah, I mean, didn't it win an Oscar?
Yeah.
Yep. Cape Fear didn't
win
an Oscar.
Yeah, and everyone loves him. That's like a very, very much beloved movie.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. You think he won that trade? Which do you think he would
have... I mean, this was at the time Scorsese's biggest grossing movie, and he did it as part of his deal so he could get The Last Temptation of Christ made. He said he would do... this and Casino if they financed or whatever, like The Last Temptation of Christ.
So the rare win-win trade.
Yeah, the win-win-win. Everyone won. Studios yeah, won. The directors won. The audiences won.
Yeah, because who would want to see a limp Spielberg version of Cape Fear? Like,
has he ever made like a for real thriller?
Like something this like scary? Like a
true thriller, yeah.
I mean, I couldn't imagine anything of this level. Although,
no,
like,
I don't think so.
I mean, I do wonder if his version, I don't know, would have been like thrilling, but not like gut wrenching, which might have been
a good
thing.
I mean, is that good? I feel like tension in a movie should be like spice in a food. And it's like, if you're not like sweating, it's not spicy enough. And so if you're like the feeling I had while watching, especially that early car scene in Nocturnal Animals was like, I love this, but I can't wait for it to be over because it's killing me.
Yeah. And you like that from your tension.
Yeah. And I mean, cause I feel like that's what you used to get with, Tarantino, and that's the number one thing that I thought was missing from from Inglourious Basterds, which had a lot of scenes like that, to mm-hmm. Django Unchained, which had zero scenes like that, and he had some which tried for it, but I don't think any of them really pulled it off. So
no.
I'll have to see Hateful Eight and see if he's got it again, because I feel like if he doesn't have at least one scene, and I think Inglourious Basterds had probably four good tense scenes uh-huh. like that, that really just make you like, you know, you kind of have a sense of what's coming and you're kind of almost like flinching as you're watching it. I love that in a tense scene.
Yeah. Inglourious Basterds opens with the most tense scene.
Yeah.
Like that he may have ever put out there.
Yeah. So, you gotta have that. And when I have spicy food, I want to be sweating. I want, you know, my nose to be running. I mean, if I'm crying, then that's like, all right, I've got the trifecta.
Just enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
All right. I guess that's going to call it for this one, little babies.
Yeah, wrap it up.
Follow us on Twitter at HardMenToPlease. Send questions or hate mail or suggestions to hardmentoplease@gmail.com and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. You said we've got a suggestion going forward?
We do have a suggestion for a future episode brought in from our listener.
Yeah?
Singular. There's a new movie coming out by, what's his name?
Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven. So the suggestion was... L? What?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the name of the movie.
Yeah, that is the name of the movie.
I thought that was, like, his name. Like, I was saying it wrong. Like, Paul without the L.
Paul L. Verhoeven.
Paul. Paul L. Yes. The movie is L. And so that's coming out. And so I didn't realize that he directed both Starship Troopers and Basic Instinct, which sounds like a great 1-2 punch, if you ask me.
He also directed Total Recall and RoboCop. I mean, he's just got a lot of fucking great movies under his belt.
Yeah. So we'll pick maybe a couple of those, see what happens.
Is L out now?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, we could do that. I think we might do Westworld, because I think it ends next weekend.
Oh, fudge. I got to watch it.
So we might do it. I have to watch the whole thing. I haven't watched any of them. So we got to... I'm actually out of time. We got to watch it now.
Okay, bye.
All right. Bye, listener. We love you.
Kisses.